Hello, everybody. Bienvenue to The Rest Is History. Tom, lots of things going on in The Rest Is History world. So the last bonus we recorded was just before our show, I think, in Washington.
And before that, we did it on a train.
But here, we're back.
Back in England.
Comfort of our own homes. So for those people who don't know, we've been in the United States. We recorded a whole load of episodes. We did two live shows. And then we returned for the most exciting date, probably of the summer.
The social highlight of the year, really, I think.
Yeah. I mean, one of the two social highlights of the year. And that was the Athelstan party. So that's for our Athelstan members. So our sort of our elite, if you like.
Our thanes.
We cherish all our members, don't we, Tom? But the Athelstans are very dear to our hearts.
That's not in any way to diss the Wangs, Dominic.
No.
The Wangs are, you know, seasoned, trained warriors. But I think the Athelstans are the Varangians.
They are the Praetorian Guard.
And actually, Dominic, when we went to New York, we had to talk about our favourite New Yorker, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I chose mine was Earl Seward, who supposedly led a whole load of Anglo-Saxon warriors after the Battle of Hastings to Constantinople, where some of them did serve as Varangians. And the rest went on to the Crimea, where they established what they called New England, and Earl Seward founded the city of New York.
Very good, Tom. And you've given me a wonderful opportunity to talk about my favorite New Yorker, who some listeners who went to the show will know, was a young man who first came to public attention in 1962. He came from Forest Hills, I think it is, in Queens. And he is, of course, Peter Parker, better known as the Spider-Man, Tom.
And you flashed up a photograph of Tom Holland playing Spider-Man, and I couldn't see it because it was directly behind me. Guffaws of laughter, and I turned around and how I laughed.
You did. Oh, you did. So we had great fun in America. We had great fun at the Athelstan party. It was lovely to meet so many of you, so many people so interested in history, which, I mean, I think we would never have envisaged when we started this podcast, Tom. And actually, I think a good time was had by all.
Yeah, it was a wonderful evening. So we did some Q&As, didn't we? And then basically we wassailed.
We did. Yeah, we mingled.
And always brilliant to put faces to the names on the Discord or the people who we've done audio messages for or anything like that. So it was really great. But Dominic, in between coming back from America and going to the Athelstan party, can I tell you what I did?
You're going to, so...
I am going to tell you, because it was a great honour. So Friday, last Friday, was the anniversary, 153rd anniversary of the death of Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah.
And the Dickens Society, to mark that occasion, they lay a wreath on his tomb at Poets Corner in Westminster Abbey. And they asked me to give the eulogy over his grave. So
wow. How many people were there, Tom?
I think there must have been about 40.
Okay. Dickens enthusiasts.
Huge Dickens enthusiasts. I think... if you were not a Dickens enthusiast, you probably wouldn't go.
It'd be a terrible occasion for you.
I think it'd be quite dull.
Yeah. How long was the eulogy?
It was about 5 minutes.
Okay, that's not too bad. Because I was thinking, if somebody asked me to give a eulogy for Dickens, I would find that intimidating on the basis that people have been eulogizing Dickens for, you know, 150 years.
I just bunged in all my favorite anecdotes. Right. So I had the great anecdote of him, how he courted his wife. His wife to be.
I don't know this.
Where he dressed up as a sailor, and he suddenly burst in through the French windows where his wife to be and her family were gathered. He danced the hornpipe, and then he jumped out backwards through the French windows, changed into his normal clothes, and then just strolled back into the drawing room as though nothing had happened.
Crikey!
Which is very, very Dickens behaviour. I mean, it's kind of faintly. I mean, energetic, funny, faintly unsettling. And with a hint of the demonic to it.
So unsettling and with a hint of the demonic, if to add to that, had he then reported news of his engagement to the physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, he would have had quite a shock, wouldn't he? Because we were just been doing two podcasts about Oppenheimer.
Yes.
And Oppenheimer, when his friend in England told him he'd got engaged, Oppenheimer tried to strangle him with the strap from his trunk.
There's a surprising amount of strangling going on in the Oppenheimer story that was news to me.
Yeah,
I don't think Dickens strangled people. So one of the books that he wrote that I hadn't read before, and I read it during the pandemic for obvious reasons, because it's about his travels through France and then into Italy.
Yeah,
and in Italy he describes watching a guillotining, And he's expressing all, saying this is a terrible thing, awful, but he's obviously completely gripped by it.
Yeah.
And it then clearly informs Tale of Two Cities with his description of the terror.
John Carey talks about that in his book, The Violent Effigy, which is all about violence and the darkness in Dickens. And he says how much Dickens loved executions, death. You know, there's a morbidity and a fascination.
Well, so this is what I talked about. I talked about how Dickens loved death. And again, one of my favorite lines from Dombey and Son. And I remember reading this when I was in the depths of learning ancient Greek. And I found it so funny that I snorted tea through my nostrils.
Oh, my word.
The huge excitement of my daughters, they were watching at the time. So this is about Miss Blimber, who the teacher of young Paul Dombey and Florence Dombey. None of your live languages for Miss Blimber. They must be dead, stone dead. And then Miss Blimber dug them up like a ghoul.
Oh, my word.
Brilliant. So I say there are many ghouls in Dickens and many who lie uneasy in the grave.
Oh, Tom, you should do a podcast for Christmas about Dickens's ghosts.
Okay, well, let's do that.
That would be great.
One on Dickens. Yeah. I mean, but excluding the obvious ghosts, because we've already done them, haven't we?
We have. But I know you love Dickens. We have often talked about doing lots of Dickens, but we haven't done it. So how about that?
Okay. Good one.
Now, let's do some questions. We have loads of questions. We're trying to get... what we'd like to do with the bonus episodes is get through as many of your questions as we can. So we've got about 25 minutes, Tom.
Yeah.
And I will kick off, because this is clearly one for you, and it's from Klaz, who we met at the Athelstan party, who is a splendid person and a moderator on the Discord. So altogether admirable. And Klaz says, why do there seem to be two popular ways to pronounce Athelstan or Ethelstan, and why should I choose the Restis history pronunciation over that of my guy, Uhtred, son of Uhtred? Last Kingdom, Pam.
So Uhtred, son of Uhtred, is the hero of the Lost Kingdom, and this is a drama, is it not? TV drama?
Based on Bernard Cornwell's Saxon stories or whatever they're called.
So I haven't seen it, so I don't know how they pronounce it.
You've never seen it, Tom?
I saw the first series, and I was so disappointed at how unlike Wiltshire they made Chippenham look, that I boycotted it.
Oh, Tom, shocking. It's actually pretty, I think it's pretty good. So I would say Athelstan. But you, for example, say Ethelfled.
No, I don't. I say Athelflad.
Oh, you say Athelflad, do you?
Athelflad. Because it's Ash. It's a letter, Anglo-Saxon letter, and it's pronounced Ah.
But what you do say, okay, you do say Athelflad, but you don't say Athelred the Unready.
No, that's because Ethelred, the pronunciation of his name, has it's the popular form that we've inherited.
And what about Alfred? Would Alfred have been spelled A-E?
Yeah.
So it's
advised by elves, literally.
Yes.
Alfred.
So how should we pronounce...
But obviously Alf has become Elf. So there's been a kind of linguistic... I don't know enough about linguistics or the changes in English pronunciation to explain it. But clearly there will be linguists out there who perhaps could explain for the benefit of us what the process was that led to Ah becoming Eh over the course of... It's the kind of the vowel shift, they talk about, isn't it?
For consistency, go around talking about elves instead of elves.
No, I wouldn't.
No, you'd sound like a fool.
But I think if I was reading a line of Old English,
and
they were talking about elves, I would. Well, because we talk about Alfred.
Yeah. So in other words, Tom, consistency is your enemy here. And Klaz can pronounce Athelstan however she likes.
No, I think that if there are words, Old English words, that begin with Ash, that over the course...
And Ash is the
result of a vowel, as a result of a vowel shift, and have remained in popular usage, of which Elf and Ethelred would be obvious examples.
Yeah.
Then go with that.
You see, I think these things are what Kingsley Amis, I'm looking at his book now, The King's English. It's a very funny guide to English usage, and he says there are certain things which are what he calls wanker detectors.
Mm.
And they are people pronouncing foreign words in excessively foreign ways.
Like Firenze.
Yeah, exactly. Harry. Roma. I'm going to Roma on holiday, you know.
Although not Beijing, of course. So we don't call it Peking.
Well, you don't.
Do you call it Peking?
If I was ordering a Peking duck, I would.
Beijing duck.
Yeah, you wouldn't say what a Beijing duck, would you?
Yeah, no.
But also I wouldn't pronounce it in a signified way. I wouldn't say... What news from...
How would you pronounce it in a signified way?
Well, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to be cancelled. But I wouldn't pronounce it, you know, I wouldn't I wouldn't affect. Yeah, Theo is saying no in the chat. I wouldn't affect a Chinese accent while.
No, all
while...
right. Well, listen. Let's. So I think we've settled this.
All right. Next question, please, Tom.
It's from Pappas, and it's for you.
Yes.
If you were forced to become a scientist, which of the scientists would you choose? And Pappas is not only a faithful Wang, but a physicist.
Well, Pappas, I've just been recording, or Pappas, I've just been recording some episodes with Tom about the life of J. Robert Oppenheimer. And I talked at some length about physics in those episodes, Tom.
You did.
But
and neutrons and...
About electrons, about all kinds of things.
Uncertainty principle, all kinds
about
of things.
About Heisenberg, exactly. Now, it's fair to say I loathed physics. It's the subject that I disliked more than any other. So that's bad news for Pappas. I didn't like any of the sciences, so I would probably choose political science.
Oh, very good.
As they call it. So in other words, people who make implausible graphs about politics... to try and smooth out all the complexity.
And are then shown to be wrong.
And they're then shown to be wrong, yeah. Attempting to reduce history to a bar chart and not succeeding. So that's what I'd do.
Good.
Jam Jam.
Jam Jam 008, or 008, I guess that would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If the Kaiser had not built up his navy, specifically dreadnoughts, would the British have stayed out of the Great War and let the continent sort itself out?
No. I think they'd have got involved anyway because... the Entente with France, the guarantees that Britain felt...
But would they have had the Entente if they weren't worried about dreadnoughts? I mean, really, for Britain,
yeah.
If they have a navy that can't be challenged, they don't really need to worry.
Well, no, I think that's not quite right. And I think it's because they get the Entente with France, not least because they're allied with Russia. And Chris Clark, who came on our podcast to talk about 1848, in his brilliant book, The Sleepwalkers... He says one of the key things about British policy before the First World War is appeasement, an appeasement of Russia. That basically we're so frightened about Russia in Central Asia and in India that we make the deal with Russia and with France to get them on side.
So it's really Britain's continental entanglements are all part of the great game.
The great game. Exactly, Tom. Yeah. Now, this is massively simplifying a very complicated story. But I think... foolishly, we would have entered the Great War, even if the Kaiser had never built a single dreadnought. So there you go.
Okay. All right.
I'll ask you this one, Tom, because this is a good one. It's got religion in it. If we're doing counterfactuals, asks Tom Hem, would Britain still be a Catholic country if Prince Arthur had lived to a ripe old age? Indeed, would Britain exist at all, given that there might not have been the personal union of the crowns under James VI and I?
So this is the elder brother of the son of Henry VII, who goes on to become Henry VIII.
Yeah.
The first of the two brothers to marry Catherine of Aragon, but who dies, thereby leaving the scene clear for Henry VIII and his various marital shenanigans and all that follows from that. We don't know is the answer. And the reason why I say we don't know is that in the Reformation, the swirl of ideas that will become Protestantism are so powerful and so strong that it's kind of like a dam bursting, and you can never be quite certain where the currents are going to go, where they're going to be blocked off, where they're going to wash things away. So I think that there are many, many ways in which England might have turned Protestant. And the evidence for that is that there is no Henry VIII in Scotland, for instance, but Scotland turns Protestant.
So the flow of ideas, books, trade links with the continent.
Yes,
stuff.
And what you see around the North Sea is that it is cities that are connected by trade around that kind of lake of the North Sea. So Amsterdam, of course, but even more importantly, to begin with, Antwerp and London, that become the key kind of motors of the Reformation. So I think it would have been impossible for Tudor England, at the very least, not to have gone there would have been a sizable Protestant presence in England, no matter what Henry VIII's relations with Anne Boleyn were. And I think that Scotland proves that. And so I think that the fact that Scotland becomes Protestant and that England, I mean, England does turn Protestant, there's a kind of inherent logic in the union of the two crowns. England and Scotland become very, very much more similar over the course of the 16th and 17th century. And in a way, the union happens because it serves the interests of both countries. I think it almost certainly would have happened.
But the union would surely not have happened if England had been Catholic. If England had gone the route of France, so France was a country with lots of Protestants, Anne Boleyn got her Protestant ideas from being in Paris. And then If England had gone the French route, so there'd been lots of Protestants, but the Catholic monarchy had won out, I don't think there would have been a union of the crowns for Scotland, do you?
I think that Scotland also is a part of that North Sea lake. And so I think that that is part of the process by which over the 16th century, the two countries become more similar.
Mm-hmm.
And because they share a language, people in Scotland become more interested in what the English are saying and vice versa for that reason. And so there is a kind of commonality. Now, and this is why I say we don't know what would happen, because we don't know what the confluence of circumstances would have been and how that might have changed the histories of Scotland and England. But what we can be absolutely certain is that Scotland and England would have faced very similar challenges.
Okay.
And they would have been dealing with very similar Protestant influences. And that would inevitably, I think, have brought both the kind of the courts and the more general literate corpus of opinion together in a way that hadn't been the case before that.
All right. Here's another question for you. Zep B. I'm reading Rubicon at the moment. Are Sulla and Marius the true cause of the fall of the Republic? Because they set the template for marching on Rome, seizing power, being super rich. They structured the legions as they did, and without them, the Republic would have kept on going. Or was the Republic a model of pushing super ambitious types to the top and they were always going to topple it? And basically he says, where are the episodes on Sulla and Marius?
I'm sure we'll do Sulla and Marius at some point. So these are warlords a few generations before the age of Caesar and Pompey, which results in the collapse of the Republic. Marius is from a plebeian background who emerges to have an astonishing number of consulships. And he is the general who essentially institutionalizes the professionalization of the legions. So a legion literally means a levy. And the idea is that it's the Roman people in war. It's Marius who essentially enables the Republic to deal with the fact that when you have a Mediterranean-wide empire, that idea of a kind of annual levy isn't really going to work. You're going to have armies in the field. And if you're going to do that, then they have to be professional. And I think that that really answers the question that Marius is doing something that someone would have had to do at some point.
Right.
And Sulla is a very aristocratic figure, much more associated with the traditional elites, but is also a very radical figure because he is the guy who first leads a legion against Rome. He's been awarded a lucrative Eastern command, and Marius is trying to diddle him out of that because they hate each other. And Sulla does the shocking thing of marching on Rome at the head of his troops. Again, I think if Sulla hadn't done it, someone else would have done it. Indeed, Julius Caesar does it a few decades later. So I think that both Marius and Sulla are the embodiment of trends that were inevitable.
Okay.
So I don't think that they are, in that sense, significant political agents. I think that they are the human embodiments of trends that were inevitably going to tear the Republic apart and also transform it into what it ultimately becomes.
Okay. I think they'd be a great subject, actually. I read Colleen McCulloch's historical novels about Marius and Sulla when I was about 12, and I thought that I was addicted. Absolutely addicted.
Okay, right. another counterfactual for you, Dominic.
Yeah.
And this is from Reticus. If Nixon's cover-up at Watergate worked, where does the second Nixon term take us? Presumably Carter and Reagan don't even happen. Or is the pro-outsider anti-establishment sentiment already in motion and baked in, but just not jet-propelled by Watergate?
Well, Reticus, I think the second sentence suggests that Reticus knows the answer, which is that the anti-establishment populist sentiment is deeply embedded in American history. It goes right back to the early days of the Republic. I think it was always the decline in institutions is baked in, to use your expression, in the 1970s. Nixon's fall does turbocharge it, but that's going to happen anyway. Two Republican terms. So realistically, you're probably going to have a Democratic win in 1976, or at least an anti-establishment win. Spiro Agnew falls anyway. Let's say Gerald Ford is vice president. Is Ford a very plausible contender running as vice president, not president, in 76? Probably not. Maybe doesn't even win the Republican nomination. Maybe Reagan wins the Republican nomination. Carter. Carter is an extraordinary, he is an extraordinary personality in American presidential history, the most implausible president before Trump. And I think maybe without Watergate, you don't get Carter, you get a slightly more establishment Democrats. But the general tone of American politics and the general narrative is probably not very different, except that Richard Nixon is making more money from speaking appearances because he hasn't been. And he's a much loved elder statesman, Tom. I mean, Nixon became something of an elder statesman anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's even more a much loved figure, not a comic figure at all, but a great winner.
Okay. Well, talking of much loved public figures, this is a question from Alex F. In the light of Prince Harry's legal cases, which historical figure has had the hardest or most unfair treatment at the hands of the media or public opinion of their time?
Well, that's a beautiful link to the previous question, because, of course, the answer is Richard Nixon. No, I don't know. Which media historical figure has had the hardest treatment?
I think there's a case for saying Marie Antoinette.
Oh, yeah. Very good, Tom. Perfect. Because, of course, the pamphlets that circulated in the years before the revolution, I mean, they were huge agents of change
often unbelievably unfair.
Unbelievably unfair. Scatological, pornographic, yeah. You know, horrendously misogynistic. And even now, you know, people sort of say, oh, let them eat cake. You don't want to be like Marie Antoinette and all this sort of stuff. And people forget that she was the victim. It's actually also xenophobic, isn't it? Because she was Austrian.
Yeah.
And the French completely took against her. So I think she's a very good call. Yeah, I like that.
Good. Okay. Well, I'm glad we agree on that. That's excellent.
So here's one for you, Tom, about another figure who's had a interesting relationship with the press. It's a question from, and that person is not Stephen Clark. It's Stephen Clark is asking the question. He says, how many times have you met Boris Johnson and what did you make of him in person?
I have met him 3 times.
Okay.
So twice it was to do with this charity, Classics for All, which aims to raise money to provide teachers and resources for the teaching of Latin in state schools. And there was a launch at the House of Commons at which Boris Johnson turned up. And in my memory, he was wearing a sheet as a toga. I may be imagining that. But he went out, and because he was there, I think he was, you know, I mean, he was, this must have been 2008 or something like that.
So Mayor of London?
No, I think it was maybe before he became Mayor of London. Can't remember. But anyway, he because he was there, there was huge press attention. So this was for the launch of the charity. And so he basically gave it the lift off that it needed. And so I felt very grateful to him for that. And then I met him again when he was Foreign Secretary. And again, he took time off from all his foreign secretarying to help out with that. So again, I was, you know, I thought that was very decent of him. I mean, people may say, I gather he was a terrible foreign secretary. So people may say, well, he was much happier.
This is the only podcast. You're definitely not going to get this on The Rest Is Politics. Praise for Boris Johnson's essential decency, Tom.
Well, I mean, it may be that he rather would have been talking about classics than dealing with Kazakhstan or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, he seems not to have been on top of all that. The other time I did it, Chalk Valley History Festival, Britain's top history festival in the beautiful Wiltshire Valley where I grew up and my brother grew up, and my brother runs it. And there was a debate in that on, you know, I can't even remember what it was. But anyway, he absolutely winged that. He did the classic thing of, what are we talking about? All that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it was clear that he had barely given the subject thought at all.
And did people laugh a lot?
People laughed a lot, and I had to pick up the pieces.
Okay.
So I was the kind of boring straight man who had actually thought about it.
Okay.
And he does that. But I've always found him, as people always say about him, he's very, very entertaining company. I mean, he's an enjoyable person to spend time with.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, maybe you don't want him organizing your COVID campaign or whatever, but
yeah,
or leading referendum campaigns, but in person I always found him very enjoyable company.
And and the stuff about classics, I mean, that's genuine, isn't it? You
think? Yeah, completely.
It's not contrived because there's no votes in it, so it'd be an odd thing to
I remember when, at the launch of the Classics for All, he said, and how are we going to get them to, you know, able to read Thucydides? And Thucydides is obviously writing in Greek rather than Latin, and his Greek is notoriously complex. And I remember the guy who was leading it saying rather nervously, I think that's possibly a little ambitious.
Right. Okay. So here's one that we can both
What about
answer.
You? Have you met him?
No, never. No.
You never met him?
No. I don't hobnob with toy top brass like you do, Tom. So here's a question from Jermaine. And Jermaine says, if you could interview anybody from the 19th century, who would it be? Tom?
Dickens.
I knew you'd say Dickens.
Or possibly Byron. No, Byron.
That's a good choice. I'm tempted to say somebody who, you know, because I like people, lots of people from the early 20th century, but I'll disbar all those and I'll just go for somebody who's pretty much most of his career is 19th century. I'll say Joseph Chamberlain, who was also my choice for, because we were asked a similar question at the Athelstan party, who should there be a statue of? And there isn't one. And I said Joe Chamberlain because I find him unbelievably interesting. Mayor of Birmingham, Tom.
Yeah.
Managed to split two different parties. First the Liberals and then the Tories. The mastermind behind the triumph of the Boer War. You don't often hear that sentence, but now you have. yeah, so I'd say Joseph Chamberlain. There you go. Peter Golbus. Oh, this is a shocking question. Have you seen this question?
Why is Dominic so dead set against Gregory VII, the great pope, the greatest revolutionary in European history, that it rises to the level of over my dead body? I don't think it is it? I mean, I think that's a little harsh on you. You are going to allow me to do it at some point.
I think it needs selling to the masses. I think it needs presenting.
I don't deny that.
So it's, if it's something called...
Europe's First Revolution.
No, I was going to say blood and...
Blood, popes, and snow.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said snow. I'd have said sex, death, and blood in the Vatican, or something like that.
Well, I mean, sex is very important, or rather the lack of it.
There you go. Lack of sex, blood, and death in the Vatican.
No sex, please. We're people.
Then I'll consider it. Now, okay. Jermaine, okay. Again. I wouldn't mind if they went through the papal schism.
Brilliant.
Well, you might not mind, Jermaine. I have read ADM. I don't even know what that is. And I still don't understand it. What's ADM, Tom?
I'm not sure.
Okay. A distant mirror.
Oh, a distant mirror. Yes, of course.
A distant mirror. Barbara Tuchman.
So we are going to do, and I've decided this, Dominic, just unilaterally, we are this summer going to do an episode on St. Catherine of Siena.
Oh, yeah. I knew that.
Who, a virgin who marries Christ and who rises to become, in some ways, she's kind of the Greta Thunberg of the 14th century, but much more important than that. I mean, she plays a really, really significant role in the history of the papal schism. And the papal schism is the Avignon exile under the influence of Catherine of Siena. She persuades the papacy to go back to Rome, and then all disaster happens because two popes are elected. End up being elected, and she's very devastated about that. So that I think is a good way into the subject. We'll cover it. And Theo has just in the messaging has just wanted me to mention that Catherine of Siena wore Christ's foreskin as a wedding ring, which she did.
Yeah, extraordinary behavior. All right, two final questions. So one is from Reticus. I'll ask you. I have a
this is Reticus's second question.
Yeah,
he's doing very
I have
well.
A very. So if you want to ask questions, go on the Discord. Or tweet to the rest is history, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. So in future episodes, I know you are immersed in this world, Tom, a world of top scholarship. And he says, my question is, what is the best Indiana Jones movie, and why is it The Last Crusade?
It's The Last Crusade.
Why?
Because the script is wonderfully funny. Edited by Tom Stoppard, I think.
Tom Stoppard came in as a ghostwriter, didn't he?
And the relationship between Indiana Jones and his father adds a kind of a really original dynamic. So I watched the Raiders of the Lost Ark as well, which is wonderful as well, but it's more conventional, I think.
So my answer to that is The Last Crusade is clearly the weakest of the original three films. It is. And the best film is without any doubt whatsoever, and anybody who disputes this is an absolute fool. It's The Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom is a brilliant film.
Which we're not doing an episode on, is it?
It's properly scary.
It's massively racist.
No, I think that's very harsh. I think it's quite a sensitive and nuanced portrait of the British Raj. I think The Temple of Doom is properly scary. It's got all the blood and guts that I look for in a film. I love the stuff in Shanghai to begin with. I think it's brilliant. Anyway, we're not going to do a podcast. We'll do a podcast about the, because it's the Tuggies, isn't it? And yeah. I think a lot of modern post-colonial scholars, Tom, yeah. would raise an eyebrow at their portrait in yeah. Temple of Doom. But it's
I think they possibly would.
It's an absolutely marvelous film. Right, final question.
But just to say, Dominic, that we are going to be recording an episode on the Ark of the Covenant
and the Holy Grail.
And the Holy Grail, but we're not going to be doing one on Tuggy.
No, but we will. I'd like to think we'll do one eventually, Tom.
Yeah.
And I can do renditions from the film. So we could do a series of films about Indy. We could do Octopussy. That's a very it's a very even-handed portrait of South Asian life in South Asia. Right. Yes. Tolmcat. In relation to Hadrian and Antinous, would Tom be able to say that the removal of Antinous to education and then as companion to Hadrian, would it have been seen as a good career move by Antinous' family? I'm thinking along the lines that he was purely selected for his beauty and that there was no choice in him becoming said companion or lover. Modern safeguarding sensibilities, of course, challenge my thinking, says Tomcat.
Oh, I mean, to be offered the chance for a brilliant education at the hands of the Emperor. I mean, yes, an amazing opportunity.
Okay.
Nothing is really done without access to Caesar. And for people in a kind of out-of-the-way town in Bithynia, I mean, it's amazing opportunity.
Okay.
It's like getting a kind of scholarship to, I don't know, Harvard or something.
Okay, very good. So keep your questions flooding in as weird and wonderful as you like. And we'll try to get through as many as we can in the next few weeks. Tom, we've got a live stream coming up, haven't we, in a couple of weeks? I've got it down on the 26th.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Love a live stream. Love not as much as an Athelstan party, but almost as much. On that note, thank you to all of you who came. Thank you to all of you who came to the live shows in London, in Edinburgh, in Salford, in Dublin, in Washington, and in New York.
And we are very much looking forward to going to New Zealand and Australia.
Massively.
Are we not?
Yeah.
So if you haven't heard about this, we are coming on tour to Down Under. And also, if you're in London, we are going to be at the Hammersmith.
Is it the Apollo? Hammersmith Apollo.
My brain went blank there.
On Halloween, on the 31st of October.
Because it's not Apollo. That's what it's called something else.
The Eventim.
The Eventim.
Yeah.
That's right.
We'll be there. So have a great week, everybody. And we'll talk to you again next week. And on that note, goodbye.
Bye-bye.